Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Monica Macias, the youngest daughter of Equatorial Guinea's first president, at just 7 years old, lands in Pyongyang, North Korea in 1979. Her father had sent her to the country to study, but what was meant to be a shorter visit grew to a decade-long stay when her father was ousted in a coup. Monica stays in Pyongyang until 94, when she graduates from Pyongyang University of Light Industry, and she decides to travel the world, to China, to Spain, South Korea, Equatorial Guinea, the US, and the UK. Everywhere she goes, people are puzzled by her background, an African woman who speaks perfect, flawless, accentless Korean. She first told her story in her biography, I'm Monica from Pyongyang, published in Korean in 2013. She now tells her story in English in Black Girl from Pyongyang, In Search of My Identity, published earlier this year. Today, we talk about Monica's story, her time in Pyongyang, her travels around the world, and what misperceptions we may have about one of the world's most isolated countries. So, Monica, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I kind of mentioned this in my intro, but maybe you could start by explaining what brought you to Pyongyang in the first place.
Thank you, Nicholas. Thank you for having me in your show. Right. So to answer that question, as I wrote in the book, the reason why we were in Pyongyang is basically, I can say it in one word, decolonization. The colonization followed by decolonization. So the colonization was characterized by the ruthless exploitation of the colonized by colonial countries' power, people and from the colonized countries like EG, where those people was considered as a subhuman, inferior to white people, with no rights whatsoever, including the right to the education. As a consequence of this, in the aftermath of the decolonization, there was no proper educational institutions left in Equatorial Guinea. So that prompted my father to send us, not only us, but also many Guineans, young Guineans, to study abroad. And that was one of the reasons why my father decided to send us to study in North Korea. And you might ask, why North Korea? This was because the relationship between Spain, who was the colonizing power of Equatorial Guinea, and the newborn country, which was Equatorial Guinea, the relationship was was very bad. For instance, like the relationship between Japan in Korea, in peninsula, entire peninsula. So it was the same situation. So as a consequence of this bad relationship, I think it was most of the communist bloc countries like China, Cuba, Russia, and North Korea was reaching out to Africa to help them, the new countries in that era. And that's how we got there in North Korea.
So in kind of, I think most people in hearing the calling it the premise seems like the wrong word, but if you would tell someone about the story of an African woman, a Black woman growing up in an overwhelmingly Korean society, I think most people would expect it to be very difficult because of the differences in terms of backgrounds, et cetera. I guess in short, did you find it difficult to be one of only a handful of people from Africa in North Korea, or was it actually quite straightforward?
I think in the beginning, I was 7 years old, so I was a child. So when I arrived in the beginning, everything was amazing to me. As I described in the book, it was completely new things and new country. So I was amazed. But then when my mom left is when I started to feeling really sad because she just disappeared from my life in over the night, and then I got very sad, and I missed her, and I started to, as she didn't come back for many years, I started to reject everything. It was difficult, and it's the Korean society is quite, it's not a mono society. So I mean, opposite to the multicultural. So being the only white black girl in the school, it made it difficult because I stand out. And so there was many factors that it made it difficult in the beginning. But afterward, you learn how to live with that. You know how you made friends, and that barrier just disappeared. So yeah, it was difficult in the beginning, but you learn how to build a relationship with the people, and also it helped when I learned the language. Also, you can in that way you can communicate. So it was beginning, yeah, like I said, it was difficult, but then it was easier.
And what was life like in Pyongyang at the time? Again, I think with the way people normally think about North Korea, and we'll talk more about this later, but they kind of extend today's North Korea backwards, or they'll do comparisons with South Korea. But I think people probably don't understand what life actually was like in North Korea during that period of time. I'm sure things were restricted, but what was your life actually like in North Korea during, I guess, during the 80s?
I mean, I would describe it within the rule they set, because each country have their own rule, and North Korea is not the exception. They have their own rule. Within those rule, one of them is that foreigners cannot interact directly with the Korean, is one of them. That was one in the beginning. It was difficult, but if you know how to build a relationship and you know how to navigate in the system that they have set, it makes it more rather easier. And about the life is, we need to go back to understand, yes, in the aftermath of the war, so when the Korean War, they're still officially they are in war, but they're in pause right now. North Korea was doing well economically, and there are documents proving it, how the country was doing better than South after the war, and they received the support from Russia back then. So they were doing well until the collapse of communism, communist countries in 90s. So that's reflected in the people's life. And I even remember one, there was, I think it was in late 80s, no, in mid 80s, if I'm not wrong, before I was still in the boarding school. I remember that Pyongyang was asking people to save things to help South Korea when they had, I think it's it there was not humane, but there was this natural disaster that happened back then, and they sent rice and then clothing. I remember that one. So back then, North Korea was not in the situation that many people have it in mind. And if we are honest, we can see that all countries goes ups and down economically, depending on the history. And we know United States had it was in 30s, and the UK as well. I think it was in 90s. So all if we look at the history of any countries, even South Korea, before they reached this, they had gone through a difficult moment, and Japan. So there are moments for the countries that they are very up in and economically. There are moments that they go very down. So when I was living in Pyongyang, the life was much better than what it is later, what it came later.
I mean, you mentioned something there that I wanted to kind of ask more about, which were, I mean, there were restrictions against kind of interaction between foreigners and Koreans, but you are able to make Korean friends growing up. Kind of, I wonder how did those relationships grow, and how did you find making friends with ordinary North Koreans?
I mean, I find it well. It's just as a normal human being. I mean, in any society, there is a this. I mean, as a human, we are very similar. The thing that we talk about, like a relationship between man and woman, and a marriage, and the worries about the in the school, the grade. And everything is not in North Korea. People, what I notice is that the outsiders tend to believe that everything in North Korea, or the human people, they 24 hour thinking about the politics, and that's simply not true. They live their life, they get married, they try to, I mean, they date. They might not do it in the way that the outsiders think, or exactly. We are just different. Different does not mean bad or good or strange or whatever, but they are human being as well. So the relationship was just about that. We worried about exams. We talk about going out to, for instance, to mountains, having the weekend, going to amusing park to have a time, boyfriends, girlfriends, and books that you have read, this discussion about the books or movies. So this kind of conversation, that's how you build the relationship with the people. I hope this
And
answers
also,
your
I mean,
question.
there's, oh yeah, and also there's access to, again, kind of every the image of North Korea is extremely isolated. I mean, but you talk about the time, like people watched things from, like people things came in from South Korea, things came in from outside. I mean, how much? I mean, you talk about it in your book, but how much kind of awareness of culture things like trends outside of North Korea was there in Pyongyang at the time?
How much said again? Can you repeat your questions?
Oh,
How much?
I mean, how much awareness, how much did people consume like culture, entertainment, pop culture trends, even from outside of North Korea, while you were like amongst your North Korean friends or even
Oh,
your
yes. Yeah, I
fellow
talk about,
foreigners in Pyongyang? Yeah.
I mentioned that in the book. So that's proof. And those who have been in that era with me in North Korea, they know that. So
Yeah. I have one more question about your time in North Korea. And then I'd like to talk more about your travels outside North Korea after 94. But you get to meet and talk with Kim Il Sung. I think there's an anecdote in your book where Kim Il Sung gives you advice. What was, I mean, again, with the understanding that this is very much one example, if I interacted with one person, what was Kim Il Sung like?
but I think I'd rather to keep that between me and him. It's a private relations, and it's a private. I rather to keep it for myself.
So in 94, you eventually decide to leave North Korea, and you You can correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of the first place you go is you go to Spain. And again, you can, like I mentioned in the introduction, but you're probably a very unique figure with a very unique background, with a very unique set of skills, particularly your ability to speak fluent Korean. But did people have like difficulty kind of understanding and like trying to understand who you were and what your background was? Do people find that, how did people find that strange, and how do they react?
Yes, it was. It is. It's still being. People are find it difficult to understand, to believe, which I understand because, like I said in the book, because they grew up in this part of the world. Because basically, after traveling and living in this societies in which ideology contrasting ideology. What I learn is that basically the world is still divided into block for me, like in co like we were living in a war Cold War. It's still divided in perception. I mean, I'm talking about perception wise. So those people who grew up in block A, let's say the Western is a block A, and the non-Western is block B, but mainly I'm talking about those formerly the block that belongs to the Russia influence. So the perception that they still have it's dated back then. They still think each other are the demons. They have misconception between them. A think B is the worst in the world, and B think A is the worst. So I step back and I look at them. Oh my God, you're just doing the same way. You think the same way, but and the reason I realize the reason why is it's because it's human being. We see the world through the eyes of us and other. There is a Canadian scholar, late Canadian scholar, he was Palestinian Canadian scholar, Edward Said, who wrote about the colonialism and Orientalism, actually. So in this book, in his essay, he described very well how it works, the us and others binary, and that was a perfect example how the people from the block A look at the block B people from the block B, and how the people from the block B sees the people from the block A. And it's amazing. And people still have that perception. And that's the reason when I'm telling them about my background, they can't believe it, first of all. They find it amazing, and they find it, some say, oh, that's lies, some say. So they're kind of all kind of opinion, which I understand, I respect, because they grew up in a one block or the other, influenced by each narratives, dominant narratives in those blocks. So yeah, I do understand that. But yes, they are quite they find it incredible.
But you also meet many Koreans on in your travels all over the world. I think you talk about meeting a Korean community in Spain. You also go to South Korea for a time. Did those Korean communities, who I expect were mostly from South Korea, I would expect, did they have difficulty kind of understanding or grappling with your background? Again, including your fluency in Korean seems to shock a lot of them, at least to you, as you tell the story.
Yes, it shocked them. They can't believe, they can't picture one woman who is biracial, because I'm white and black as well, speaking flawless Korean with no accent to them, and they can't associate in, they can't picture it, and but that's the first impression, yeah, when they see me start talking. But then when I got to know them and we share, we start talking, they tell me, oh, I feel like I'm talking to an Asian. I feel like I'm talking with Korean person. Korean, you say it. Our people is a very common expression in Korean. They say, 우리 사람, 우리 사람. That means our people. I feel like I'm talking to someone, one of us. So they can't believe it, but I understand that it's normal because Korea, whether it's South or North, has been so long time mono society, where so Korea is becoming right now, it's multiculturalism now growing in South Korea is a very recent thing happening, yeah. But it's been really, really mono, how you say, opposite to multicultural society. So it's understandable. I do understand it. And when I first arrived in Seoul back then, in a tube, I didn't speak Korean because everyone was just staring at me, surprised and amazed, and not knowing what to do. So I was just like keeping my mouth shut and not talking in the, when my friends calling me in a, and they catch me in the train. So yeah, that was the reaction. So it's normal. It's understandable. I understand that reaction. Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I guess one more question about your travels. I mean, you travel back to North Korea after you leave, you do get the chance to return to your boarding school and everything. I mean, what was that experience like returning to North Korea after spending that time abroad? How had your view of the country and the city change?
I mean, it was a feeling of going back home. That feeling is amazing for everyone, I think. I mean, it's the place I grew up. It's the place I met. I have friends. It's the place that I spend the most important part of my life, which is childhood, adolescent, and part of my adulthood. So imagine for anyone, how would you feel going back home? You're happy. Now, you're asking me how I saw the society. It was hard to see because it was 2004, so it was the most difficult moment for them, and so I could see it reflected in the society where I felt like the city was stuck in the time. So it was sad, but at the same time I was happy to going back to visit my school, my lecturers in the university, and I was so lucky because I met my classmates there who After graduation, she stayed as a lecturer in the university, and so we could speak, we could chat. And so that was, I mean, it was amazing, you know, when you meet again your friends of childhood. And well, she wasn't from childhood, actually. We met, and she was a classmate in university, but nevertheless, it was I was happy to meet them, meet her and my lecturers. Yeah, it brought me a lot of memories, so.
So I'd like to kind of wrap this up, and apologies for some preamble for this question. I think a lot of people who look at North Korea from the outside, which is a lot of people, I think they have a certain image of the country. It's North Korea is very isolated. They read stories about the famines. They read stories about the about political repression, things like that. And thus they have a very they have a very they have a certain view about the country. Then you read accounts from people who are actually there, and we've done books like that on this show before. We actually talked to ordinary North Koreans, and the understanding is quite different. For example, North Koreans, they know what's going on in the rest of the world. Like they know what's going on in South Korea. They know what's going on in China. And I guess how in your view, how are the kind of the way the world thinks about North Korea, how does it affect what we think about the country? How does it affect how we think about what to do about North Korea as a country or as a population? I guess how are these views coloring our understanding of North Korea and what to do about North Korean questions?
You know, there is a Nigerian famous writer. She is really brilliant, Chimamanda. She gave a brilliant speech. Have you heard about her? No.
I have not go, but what's
Okay, but
the
it's okay. If you have time, just I'll suggest to Google her about the single narrative. How dangerous and how manipulative is the single narrative she talks about? She calls it single story, and I call it single narrative. And when you show the people one single story or one single narrative, what you do is dividing us, right? I believe we, all of us, including you, everybody, we want a better international society, a better societies around us. I believe we want that. If we really want that, what we should do is not telling the people one narrative in order to divide them. Because when we divide, what we create is hate each other. Yeah, hate. And then we create this misconception on purpose. And in that way, we make people, by telling them only one narrative, we made people to just to think from one perspective, not seeing everything, because that's not, it doesn't help us for to achieve what we want, which is a better society where there is no human right issues, where is everyone have the same respect. That's what we want. So let's start by not telling people, but not dividing people by telling them a single story. That's what I wanted to do. That's why in the end of my book, I said inclusive. Everyone have a right to say what they understand, what they see. But let's not omit the other part on purpose and tell the people what suits us. You read my book from the beginning to the end. I do I do talk about what is wrong and what is wrong of the societies that I have that, but I admit there is another side of them, because I don't want to politicize by telling people. I don't want to politicize perspective in order to divide people. That's not what I'm doing, and I will not do it, be doing that, because there is no nation who owes moral authority to lecture others. None of them. I really have reflected on that issue. Who owes the moral authority? Can you name me one? I can bet a thousand billions dollars, and no one can mention me that this society owes the moral authority, therefore can lecture others. There isn't.
You noted in an earlier answer how how for much of the post-war history, it was actually North Korea that was the stronger economy, stronger than South Korea. I think that's clearly not true anymore. I think South Korea is very clearly a wealthier economy. It's a cultural powerhouse. And then people may take Was it, they may take the compa today's comparison and extend it backwards, as in say, oh, South Korea was always the stronger economy, always the stronger cultural, and they take the current disparity and extend that backwards. I mean,
I think
do
I
you think,
see.
yeah, do you
I
think
think.
that has South Korea's success, and recent success, do you think that's changed how people understand or talk about or have a certain image of North Korea?
I'm not sure how people, because I didn't do the research about that, but I think what you're trying to say is that this again links to the what I said earlier, that the knowing that any countries go through ups and downs in their moments in the history in economy. So if I mean by common sense, I mean we I would say if I want to know and which is what I do. If I want to know about a country, I do research and I really do academic research. That's the reason I came to London to study, to understand myself, to understand. So before jumping in the conclusion, I think people would do, because there are people out there who, when they want to know, they will do the research background research and go deep academic, not what Wikipedia said, because Wikipedia is not really reliable, but they would do an academic research and they could see that any country have these moments that when the economy goes up and the economy goes down, depending on the political situations around the world and or in the country itself. So I think my answer to that, I don't know, because I didn't know, I didn't do the research about that, asking to the people about that. I didn't do any survey, so I can't give you an accurate answer. However, the common sense tells me that if someone wants to know, would go through a really rigorous research about that and learn about it. That's my answer.
I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Monica Macias, author of Black Girl in Pyongyang, In Search of My Identity. Monica, I actually have two more questions for you, which are where can people find your work and what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
So they can order my book on Amazon. It's available on Amazon. It's been there from March, and they can buy it there. And the second, what I'm gonna do? Well, I like to, so with my experiences and what I have learned from living around the different societies. I want to contribute to help people to understand each other, and we bring, if that can help, we bring a peaceful society rather than telling people one single story, like Chimamanda said, how dangerous is that? I want to tell people my story, and through my story, if I can help others who is going through racism, because I have suffered racism in this country, London, where I'm staying, and I want to help them. That's what I want to do so far. And and contribute, like I said, contribute to helping others and more inclusive society, not exclusive one where only those who are privileged have a voice. Because I, as a non-white, I realized that I am not privileged in this society. Is in order to be privileged, you have to have your skin must be white, so you can even navigate through the system differently. So I want to help to eliminate that barrier that and fight about that.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. We urge you to subscribe and listen to the Asian Review Books podcast now on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, and share us with your friends. If you want to support us continuing to write in a interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Peter Tilley, author of The Opium Business, A History of Crime and Capitalism in Maritime China. But before then, Monica, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Nicholas, for having me.